Today, the jobs printer goes bruh. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news. I've got Tarek Brooker back on for another chat. Hi, Tarek. Good to see you once again.
Thanks for having me, Martin. It's great to be back.
Yeah, I know. I know you have a lot on, so I really appreciate you carving out a bit of time. But look, there are so many things that we want to talk about and so many worrying signs, particularly the Australian economy and perhaps what's happening in the US too. But interesting times. And at the moment, it seems to me that both sides of politics are playing a lot of announceables and not wanting to do anything to really tackle the underlying issues we've got.
No, I mean, I think that that's sort of been a bit symptomatic of the way things have been in Australian politics for a while now. You know, prior to the 2022 election, you know, had Albo saying, well, no, I'm not going to support a return to high immigration. That wouldn't, you know, and I don't support, you know, high levels of temporary migration either. That's not the right way we want to go about things. And then he turned it up to 11. And I feel like a lot of people are now looking at the same proposals from Dutton, who are saying, oh, no, I want to reduce temporary migration. I want to reduce this, 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 and this. And the lack of detail and just feeling a little bit of deja vu with what Albo was telling them prior to the last election.
Well, I think it shows you that it's all politics, really. And it's interesting that the opinion polls are showing pretty much line ball between the two parties. And in some cases, Albo's behind slightly. I think people are waking up to the fact that, both of the major parties really are just spruiking left, right and centre. But when you actually try to peel back the onion and look at what's really happening, what's really going on, there's a massive gap between what people are talking and what people are seeing. And a good example, of course, is the recent discussion with regard to the RBA and the trajectory of interest rates, because the inflation is still high. Inflation is being stoked by those handouts from government, despite what the government may say. And in fact, the IMF came out earlier in the week and said that over the next year, Australia's inflation will be probably the second highest, significantly higher than most other Western economies, which indicates to me that the trajectory that we're on is not a good one.
No, I think that we're on a rather different trajectory to the rest of the world, and not in a good way. I think that it's all well and good for people to say, well, we don't have a recession like country X or country Y, and we don't have the same level of rising unemployment as other nations and blah, blah, blah. But I think that we are embedding a level of dependence on government that is quite worrying. Now, I know, and I think that this is just worth emphasizing, that I'm not the sort of normal, you know, person who's just anti-government more broadly. The government has a place, you know, to do the things that it needs to do, you know, to provide that basic level of safety net, to provide basic, you know, basic services like, you know, healthcare or education. But I think what's happening is we are seeing the rise of, you know, the taxpayer-funded economy, which we're going to get into in great detail later on in the show with the slides. We're seeing the rise of this taxpayer-funded economy. And the question then becomes, okay, when it's not raining money at Treasury, when they're not underestimating migration, when the money isn't falling out of the sky because of the impact of, you know, high commodity prices, and if China goes off the boil, and then we now have a Treasury and a government who has to make hard choices, who is going to be the ones who bears the brunt of the cuts? Who are we going to cut the gravy train? You know, for these people, you know, say for example, you know, for some of these NDIS contractors who are making out like bandits, who are charging, you know, six times market value for a disabled toilet, for, you know, a disabled shower stall, you know, or is it going to be frontline essential services that gets cut, like what happened in Britain, you know, where they cut the number of firemen, they cut the number of police officers, they cut the real wages of health staff. And, you know, did the gravy train stop? Nope.
Well, it is very interesting. You mentioned the UK. We have a budget here next week. And they have just announced that they're changing the rules of the fiscal rules, which allows them to borrow up to an additional £50 billion a year. Now, the argument is that they're actually reclassifying things like student loans as an asset and those sorts of things. So they're actually doing some shenanigans, but they're also going to lift taxes dramatically. This is Labour we're talking about in the UK, because there's this massive black hole. And I find it fascinating that the IMF did actually make the commentary that while monetary policy, they tightened interest rates around the world to try and deal with inflation, fiscal policy has been really, really loose. And so a lot of governments around the world have been throwing a lot of money in the system, and it's now coming home to roost, because effectively what it means is that the ability to be able to invest in the things that we need to invest in is becoming more and more difficult. By the way, things like investing a lot more in defense is sort of seen as absolutely needed. So that's sort of top priority. But a lot of the other stuff, things that you would have expected, like in the health sector and in the support for education and those sorts of things, they're actually being squeezed. So again, it shows you that the policies that actually are being spoken about and executed are actually leading to higher levels of fiscal debt, higher levels of costs that the government is going to have to continue to support through, of course, higher interest payments. And that then puts a lot of pressure on tax policy. Most people are paying more tax than normal for, they've been for a long, long time, and other things too. So I have a feeling that not just in Australia, but in other countries too, people have gone off the rails and we seem to have lost the plot.
Well, it's just good old burnout economics. It's one foot on, it's the central banks, the Bank of England, the RBA, with their foot on the brake, and with government with their foot on the accelerator, and they're just completely just opposing forces acting on each other. And the problem is that all of us who are being subjected to this are effectively going nowhere. We're getting into all this debt, we're creating all of this dependence on government. And I think the thing is if you had have said to me, okay, we're gonna spend X number of dollars on, I mean, like, I'll give you an example. Like, the size of government relative to GDP compared with where it was in 2019 in Australia has risen by almost 5 percentage points, right? So 5 percentage points of GDP is about $125 billion, though thereabouts. Now, you could do a lot with $125 billion a year. Now, if you were saying, oh, well, we're going to fix bulk billing and we're going to get more nurses and we're going to fix this X, Y, and Z, then I would say, okay, let's have a look at that particular proposal, line by line, and let's fix what needs to be fixed. But have we fixed it? Nope. We're still seeing deteriorating emergency room outcomes. We're still seeing deteriorating rates of bulk billing. And well, we're spending all the money, but we're not getting any of the benefit. Well, when I say we, I mean the broader public. I'm sure that there's some people out there who are getting a whole hell of a lot of benefit from it, just not the right people.
Well, that's right, and that's why real incomes for many people are still going backwards. And I'm fascinated by the focus on the most recent Roy Morgan ANZ consumer confidence report, because everyone was celebrating, oh, it's gone up, but look where it went to, and they're still well below long-term trends. The fact is that many people are saying, oh, this is pretty chronic, and it's really difficult to try and make my way through. There was an ABC report that showed that some households are spending between 15 and 20% of their disposable income on tolls, just to get around Sydney, for example. So, it's not surprising that a lot of people are saying, well, what is going on? There's this huge diversity, this gap between reality and what the politicians are spruiking and what the politicians are saying. And I guess that's the real background here. Now, we should probably move on into the slides, because we want to keep this into a fairly net conversation. And I think your intro slide here is just brilliant, right? Because it really shows you that this is all about printing public sector jobs, really.
Yeah, pretty much. Well, as usual, the charts will be found at burnouteconomics.com, and I do actually have an article out today on the ye olde jobs printer in a lot more detail. So I'll send Martin a link to that to put in the description. And without further ado, I should say, we should get into the slides. Now, there has been a lot of discussion on the issue of the so-called migration catch-up, that there's this big trough in the number of migrants coming through, and that we need to fill it, and yada yada blah blah. Now, I don't think that that's an especially instructive or helpful way to look at things. This is a chart of the actual number and the growth, the actual number of households, and the growth in, so I should say, the growth in the number of households yearly from the ABS. Now, as you can see, we are growing the number of households by almost 300,000. The number of houses that we've actually built and weren't knockdown rebuilds is about 150,000. So we grew our housing deficit over the 2023-2024 financial year by about 140,000 homes. Now, if you extrapolate that out into the future and to how much we need to then cut the level of migration and population growth, you're talking about cutting a severe cut on what is on pre-COVID levels for, well, a severe cut on probably 160K a year, I would say, out to potentially, depending on how severe you want that cut to be, all the way out to probably the past 2030. So I think that this just illustrates just the scale of the problem, and that there are more factors at work other than just population growth divided by 2.5, which is roughly the average household size. It's much more complex than that, and the government needs to acknowledge that before this blows up in our face even worse than it already has.
Well, it's very interesting, and certainly in my surveys, I've seen the growth in the total household count continuing to rise. The mixture of households are also quite different, so that there are quite a few more now single households beginning to form, but there are also now households where people are clubbing together to sort of create a household unit, multiple separate people trying to buy a single place together. There's a dynamic going on here in terms of housing formation and the mix of housing formation, which is quite important. At the other end of the spectrum, I'm also seeing households who are still now working despite getting into the 60s and into the 70s. So the move into retirement has also slowed considerably. In fact, the ABC covered my analysis this week on a couple of programs and on a website link as well. And so the whole household formation and development is something which, as you say, is way more complicated than just divide everything by 2.5.
Indeed. I mean, like, I've gone through the, been going through the data on this for a couple of years now since the ABS has been putting it out. And if you look at the numbers, the purely just due to the changes in household demographics, which is household size, the number of people living alone, people having fewer children, all these things, feeding through the so-called demographic python over time, purely just in 2023, 2024, in that single year, that added demand for 65,000 homes. Now that's over one third of all the homes that were built over that same period. So, and that also includes knockdown rebuilds too. That's not accounting for knockdown rebuilds or empty homes or any of the other factors that are at work. So this is a major, major factor. This is a huge issue. But it doesn't get the airtime that it deserves because, one, it's abstract and complicated, and those issues are tend to be sort of left on the back burner. But it's also very politically difficult for the government, because if you take 65,000 homes and you multiply that by 2.5, that's the number of fewer migrants that you have to have in order to have a balance between housing supply and housing demand.
Yeah, well, supply, of course, is definitely a problem in terms of, and in fact, all the hearings this last few days on housing has all been on the housing supply, 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 and everyone's talking about supply. But you've got to understand the demand drivers. The demand
Yeah.
drivers are the critical, which is a combination of migration and the household formation and those changes. And I don't see any sensible discussion about marrying the supply and demand drivers.
Which is kind of insane when you think about it, because this is stuff that that most people learn in sort of like year nine business studies. I'm pretty sure some primary schools teach it in the senior years at this point. It's literally just, basic supply and demand economics. It's, I wouldn't even say it's economics 101. It's like just the most rudimentary basic thing. It's like, why does it, it's like, why does a packet of toilet paper cost more during the pandemic? Well, it costs more because of supply and demand. It's literally like the most basic expression of things. Yet it's just ignored because it's inconvenient. And, these other demand drivers that are coming to the forefront, like demographics, are just even, just being ignored to an even greater degree. And I'm just, I share, I mean, I have serious concerns about how this is going to be managed going forward, because we could cut migration to what the Treasury forecast will be, and it could be anywhere near enough on the numbers that I've seen. And I've spoken to other people about this, economists and stuff off the record, and they share my concerns. And I am just, to be completely honest, somewhat fearful of the Australia that that is going to create, both in terms of social cohesion and just the economics and the living standards issues of it all.
Well, of course, the living standards issue is going to be important. The most recent recommendations from the New South Wales Productivity Commission was to build higher, build smaller, reduce the facilities in the properties that are being constructed. And we saw, of course, in Melbourne the 50 zones that have been announced now for further high-rise development. So, it's a high-rise, small place to live future. Interestingly, many people that I survey don't have any interest in living in that sort of environment. Maybe some of the migrants are happy to, but others aren't. I think that's an important factor. The other one, to going back to my point about older households who are still working and working for longer, they're not looking to downsize until quite a lot later into retirement because they've got this huge mortgage burden. And many more people now go into towards retirement with a mortgage and decide they've got to go on working. So maybe not full time, but certainly part time. And that means that they don't necessarily need the same sort of properties as perhaps people think that they need. So there's a huge, huge question here that is just not being explored adequately. And that's why we're getting really dumb, really, really dumb policies, which is to say, well, we'll just go on printing people. And by the way, as we'll see in a second, where are those people working? Mostly in the public sector. So if you look at jobs growth recently, it's all public sector jobs.
Yeah, and I just think on the topic of, the older people and the issue and the issues with our housing supply that creates in terms of like the actual distribution of based on the size of homes. I mean, I've spoken to some older people about this, as sort of a bit of a case study. And when I've mentioned to them, are you going to downsize? A lot of people have said to me, well, not in this rental market, because what happens if my children can't find a place? They'll at least have a place here with me. And, I mean, looking at that, just purely from a sort of human perspective, I mean, if I was in their shoes, I think I would just totally understand that perspective, because, you can't have your kids boomerang home into a three bedroom apartment, but you can have them boomerang home when you've got a four or five bedroom house. So I feel like just bad policy is just driving bad outcomes, really.
Well, that's the point. And again, myopic discussions about one small element of the story without understanding how the holistic nature of all of these things come together.
Yeah, exactly, unfortunately. Okay, now what I've done here is I've taken household formation, which is expressed by the ABS in terms of the actual net number of households being formed every year, and growth in housing supply. Now, this particular analysis starts in 2005, because that's when the ABS household size data series begins. And what I've done here is I've taken dwelling completions at a national level, and I've made a few assumptions. 10% of dwelling completions do not result in a net addition to dwelling stock. As of the latest data, it's more like 15, but I've decided to be conservative, to be, sort of give this the best possible result of a decent set of outcomes, which, as you can see, hasn't happened anyway. And also about 5% of homes being empty. Now, the estimates at the census are about 10%. The lower end estimates I've seen recently from PropTrack are about 5%. So I've used the lower end estimates again. So this is giving everything the best possible chance of succeeding. And if you look at it, the number, now this is cumulative over time. So we've either got a housing surplus, housing shortage. Now we had a relative surplus build during COVID because, well, we built more homes than we had growth in the number of people. But as you can see, it's now expanded to a record deficit of almost a quarter of a million. So this is not something that is going to be resolved in a swift fashion. Not with the way that we're building homes, not with the fact that homes are now so expensive to build, but you're talking about, sort of 4.5 times average male earnings just to build the house. Now that's just for the construction work. That's not the infrastructure, it's not the land, it's not anything else. It's just that's just to build the property. So it's a bit of a mess, really.
It certainly is. And that number, 241,000 down, that's huge. If you think of the context of the forward building approvals that we've got at the moment, which are, of course, quite low at the moment, and a lot of the construction industry is saying it's almost impossible to make any money when you actually are building because of the high supply costs and because of the labor costs. It's not surprising that this is getting more and more intractable, and of course, overlaid with what level of migration?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean this is something that I mean like HIA recently put out an analysis that suggested that they reckon that housing completions are going to peak out around about 190K, down from about 227, a peak of about 227,000 prior to the pandemic. Now I think that's actually pretty ballpark. I think that's sort of right in the zone of where things could go if things work out okay. But yeah, it's a profound mess. I mean, I think the thing is even if you just choose to say, okay, we're gonna fix this deficit over, say, 10 years, which is a very protracted period, that's still 24,000 over 24,200 homes a year, the extra that we need to build. So, that means that someone needs to say to Albo, well, you're gonna have to reduce migration by well over 50,000 people a year, just to be able to start to make some ground on this. And that's not including the fact that we're going to have a deficit of housing year after year anyway, and this number is only going to keep growing, which is really kind of insane when you think about it. I mean, it's just, we've got this rental crisis, we've got all these issues, yet the politicians just can get away with creating this complete mess and then just make the mess worse.
Well, that's right. And let's talk about the idea of increasing the ability of banks to lend by reducing the buffers that are required, right? And that's a policy that's being mooted by the other side of politics, or indeed increasing further the incentives for first-time buyers to try and make them buy, or indeed in what Victoria has already announced, reducing stamp duty if you buy a high-rise property. Including, by the way, people from overseas. So they're turning up the demand levers even more by some of those, without actually thinking about the implications on the total dynamic of supply demand. I find this remarkable, and of course, it comes back purely to this. This is a game of politics being played out on housing rather than a game of economics. And that's the problem. We've actually got people posturing and positioning to try and sound good and look good without actually necessarily tackling the critical issues that need to be tackled.
Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting just to see how quickly this turns into a complete mess politically. Because I think that the housing issue is increasingly one that is contributing significantly to the issues that the government is facing in terms of its popularity, in terms of its appeal, and in terms of, sort of considerations of its competence. And I feel like this is something that sort of can't just be left to fester again and again and again. The governments are going to be punished for this a lot more frequently than they otherwise would be, and they, that they got away with in the past. So I think that the next few elections are going to be quite interesting in that regard. I mean, the fact that Dutton stands any chance at all of forming a government at the next election, and the fact that he's ahead in some of these polls, is just an enormous indictment for just how poorly this government has performed.
Yeah, and it's interesting that whether you saw the interview with Chalmers when he was in Washington, but he was tackled about the IMF's conclusions, and again, it's like what he thinks to be true about the way the economics are working and what he's doing is at odds with almost what everybody else is saying, but he still thinks he's right. So there's an interesting dichotomy there between perhaps truth, reality, and the political spin. And I have to say that both sides of politics, I said to Edwin the other day, are spinning like tops.
I can't disagree with you on that one, mate. Okay, now this is a chart of the growth of the number of total households and single persons households since the middle of 2019. Now, as you can see, single person households are growing at a rate of about 60% faster. Now, part of this is the aging of the population, which is just inevitable, but part of it is also just more people choosing to live alone. Now, part of that is due to international students, which are about almost three times more likely to live alone than other people, than normal members of the population in that sort of general age demographic. But this isn't a trend that is stopping. It is continuing to accelerate, and it's going to be something that's going to continue to put upward pressure on housing demand. So yeah, and I think it's also just worth noting that, we sort of haven't had the big sort of family breakups and stuff like that that have been seen in other nations, say for example, like in the US during the GFC, that boosted household formation. So, this is very much just a sort of more organic occurrence. So, and not only that, but an organic occurrence amidst a backdrop of enormous rises in costs. Which in some ways, makes you wonder what it's going to look like going into the future. Is the single person household, trend just going to take off even further, if we do start to see some of those pressures abate?
Well, it's definitely likely to, because at the other end of the spectrum, again, in my surveys, I'm seeing people of older age not wanting to move into some of the retirement options that used to be there, partly because, of course, they're highly expensive and highly restrictive. And also the sense that they want to try and maintain independence, even if they've lost a partner. It's also worth highlighting the fact that some of the NDIS implications are that there's more support available for people living in the community rather than actually in other settings. So all of those strategies at the other end of life are actually saying we are going to see more single person households going off into the future. And again, it comes back to this fundamental point. If you're not doing this sort of analysis and understanding the dynamics, then you're not going to make the right decisions with regard to housing policy.
No, and I think the thing is that they just, I can't really see any of this getting much of a look in, to be completely honest with you, mostly just because, the RBA, to their credit, has talked about this. They've actually talked about it a few times. They've written a few papers on it, and I respect them for raising this issue. But in terms of the political sphere, I think this sort of thing is kryptonite because it completely undermines any sort of reasonable approach. Sorry, it completely undermines their approach to think to issues like population growth, issues like migration, issues like housing, because you look at something like this and you go, well, you can't do what you want to do. You can't run the level of migration that you want to run because it's gonna completely screw up the housing sector even more. There's a reason why CBRE, the sort of commercial real estate firm, says that the rental crisis in terms of, as measured by vacancy rates, is going to still be around well into 2019, sorry, not 2019, 2029. That is absolutely insane. You just, I think that, someone should, realistically get out there, and force Albo to say, if we continue on the current course, when is the rental crisis going to end? When is housing going to be affordable? When are we going to have enough homes for everyone? When are we going to see an abating of the upward pressure on the number of people accessing or needing to access services for being homeless? All these are very, very important questions, but we're not getting the answers, and I don't imagine that we're going to.
Well, it's inconvenient for those answers to come out. That's the main point I would make. If you and I were writing the intergenerational report rather than the politicians, right, I think we'd have a very different story about what is really going on, what the dynamics are, and what it actually means in terms of policy outcomes. That's the difficulty because, again, there's no joined up thinking. If you actually take all of the data that we've touched on and the other information that's out there and just do some sensible thinking, then we're going to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the really just, concerning and other words that are sort of more severe than concerning. That just that, where does all this end? What does this give rise to in the political sphere? I mean, Australia. I mean, you look at say you look at Germany, right? You've got the AfD, you've got the rise of the populist left. The populist left and the populist right, in some cases, winning almost 50% of the vote between them. And not only that, but they're not winning it from a bunch of, disenfranchised older people. They're winning it from a bunch of angry young people. And I look at Australia and I just think, not we, but our political class has been very lucky that we haven't had those same types of parties come up here in Australia with the same level of appeal and sort of what would you call it, just the same level of broader mass appeal for people. Like people, we have our own sort of versions. We've got the Greens and we've got One Nation, but the idea of, say, 40%, 50, 60% of young people getting out there and voting for those two, and those two, putting them first. That's something that is a little bit rare. I'm not saying young people. I'm not just talking about people who are 18 to 24 who vote Greens. I'm talking about people who are sort of under 40, and I think that we're ripe for that sort of a populist movement to arise.
Well, maybe that's why the MAD bill, the misinformation and disinformation bill, perhaps quite relevant, right? Because effectively they're trying to restrict some of the discussions that this sort of discussion, even, because of course we could be argued to be questioning the economic foundations of the country and the financial system by doing this, right? But it is really important. And I think the other point is that the level of political engagement in Australia generally is quite low. So, there's a small political group who are quite active, but a lot of people, well, they're struggling to just to get by and the sun's shining and the beach looked quite nice. So let's not bother. But I'm not sure this is going to play out in such a benign way ahead, because the issues that we're talking about here, which is about people's futures and their ability to find somewhere to live and form a family and have kids, those sorts of things, the fundamentals of life, well, they're actually now under question.
Yeah, they are. Absolutely. And I think that the thing is that our society is ostensibly, and sort of it's claimed to be built on choice, personal freedom. Yet, if you look at the people trying to have a home or to have children or to do all these different things in, sort of great swaths of the country, it's not a choice anymore. The idea that even that a parent could stay home from work for a couple of years to spend time with, during the formative years of their kid, that's not really viable anymore in a lot of different places. And I mean, my mother was part of, the sort of feminist movement back in the day. She still very much is, but this was outside Australia, back in her home. And she fought hard for choice. If a woman wanted to stay home and raise a family, then great. That's her choice. You know, if a woman wanted to go to work, then great, that's her choice, but it's about choice. You know, and if a parent, male or female, wants to stay home with their children during their formative years, then I think that that should be something that we collectively strive for. Because I think it's better for a child to be raised by their family than raised by a stranger. Now, people can have their own opinions on that, but you know, I'm an old school ethnic bloke, and that's just the way I see it.
Well, it is a very, very important point. And of course, you lay the foundations of society by the way that kids are brought up, the way that they're educated, the role models that they're exposed to. And so you've got to question whether, in fact, some of those foundational elements are actually rather defective at the moment, which can well lay issues for the future. And I also, again, in my surveys and in my one-to-one conversations, have lots of discussions with people who are desperate to try and form a family and form a stable basis to have kids. But when they do the numbers, they can't afford to find somewhere to live. They can't afford the childcare costs in the first couple of years because both would have to still work to be able to actually pay the mortgage or pay the rent. So the foundational elements that are there to allow people to do the things that people need to do and want to do are just being eroded left, right, and center. And that's the fundamental reality. Now, okay, there are people who are very significantly better off and able to make these decisions. And so not everybody's in this bucket, but there are so many people that coming, I see in the surveys that are now caught in these really difficult decisions, massive dilemmas about trying to figure out what to do. And in some cases, people are saying, well, maybe actually Australia isn't the place for our future. And that's a very concerning observation.
Well, it's interesting you should mention that, because the other day the ABS released the latest fertility rate data, which, if you go into the tables, breaks it down by region, and that they've been doing that regional breakdown now with the total fertility rate for about a bit over a decade now. So you get to look at it and you get to see some trends, and you look at some of these regions that have become sort of refuges for people, you know, leaving Sydney, leaving Melbourne, leaving these more expensive suburbs all the way back to 2013. And you see that, you know, you see these regions, and then you see that their fertility rates are significantly higher because the cost of living, in particular the cost of housing, is significantly cheaper. But now you've seen the impact of more and more people moving out of these places, sorry, moving out to these places. Housing prices and housing costs rising, whether it be rent or whether it be property prices. And now you're starting to see, you know, those issues that you're talking about, you know, where people are having their freedom of choice taken away by circumstance growing into these regional areas. And I think that you're right. I think that a lot of people over time, and particularly, you know, sort of young people, late 20s, 30s, you know, who want to have a family, who want to, you know, have this type of life, have chosen over time, okay, maybe I'm going to move to a smaller, you know, looking back, you know, 10, 15 years, you know, it's like maybe, you know, I'm going to leave Sydney, I'm going to move to a smaller capital, or I'm going to move to a regional area. And, you know, that's what they've done. That's what the data shows, you know, this exodus out of Sydney in net terms. And, you know, and the problem is that as people leave, as prices get pushed up in these places, these options are being taken off the table, you know, more and more. You know, it used to be, I'll go up the Central Coast. Well, now most of the Central Coast, you know, the lower half of it, houses are $1 million. And the idea of doing that to save money, you know, really isn't neither here nor there anymore. So you just keep spreading and spreading and spreading and spreading. And, you know, I talk to people about it, and I really understand why a lot of people are just saying, well, I can't make Australia work if I want to have the kind of life that I want to have. And, you know, the things like having a family wait for no man, you know, that you can't just magically, you know, just keep the clock going forever.
No, very true. And the other point about moving into regional areas, and again, I've seen it in the surveys, is that the availability of the sort of standard services you'd expect from childcare through to medical services, or even things like banking services, because of course banks have disappeared from a lot of regional areas. It means it's very, very difficult to make the sort of the standard decisions you'd want to make in terms of the services that are accessible and available to you in the regional areas, because they have been significantly disadvantaged relative to the big urban centres. And one of the shocks that a number of people have had as they've moved out is to discover just how little support they can get, conveniently and locally in those regional areas too. So there is not a simple answer to this question.
No, unfortunately not. We should probably move on to the next slide. Okay. Now, this is also from my article on the old jobs printer. And what we've got here is two parts of the same graph. We've got the pre-GFC non-market jobs, which is healthcare, education and training, government, public administration, all that sort of stuff. It's not necessarily public, not necessarily public sector, but it is generally government funded. So if you look at the trend there from the start of the data series in 1994 through to the financial crisis, it's broadly flat. And then if you look at from the time of the financial crisis onwards, all of a sudden it surges, and it surges quite strongly. And what we've seen is these non-market jobs, these government funded jobs, taking over as the main driver of employment growth. Well, not necessarily taking over. It's been about 50. It was about 50-50, but more recently, it's very much tilted towards the government funded job side of things.
And that's the point, isn't it? Government-funded jobs, in other words, jobs that taxpayers directly or indirectly are actually paying for.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think the problem is that as we talked about before, if this was all just, nurses and GPs and all that sort of stuff, I don't think people would really have a problem with it. But you're talking about a significant expansion of this part of the workforce that just keeps growing and growing. And I'm pretty sure, yeah, here we go. This chart is of what it looks like on a rolling 12-month basis. Now, the red is non-market jobs, green is market jobs. And as you can see, we've seen the number of these non-market jobs surge to huge, huge all-time highs under the Albanese government. Now, to be completely fair to old Albo, not all of these people are being paid by the federal purse, although a lot of them are through things like the NDIS, but a lot of them are also being employed by the state by state and local government. So, it like as I said previously, it raises that uncomfortable question of are all these people, all these jobs that we've created, are these going to be the people who are going to be first on the chopping block when there are challenging times at Treasury? Or is it going to be the people who are providing the most essential frontline services that are going to be the first to cop it?
Yeah, a very good point. And again, the jobs that are being created are being funded by states, federal, directly or indirectly. As you say, not necessarily jobs in the public sector directly, but funded by the state and federal. And that's one of the reasons why the overall level of debt in Australia, from the public sector perspective, continues to go through. Look at Victoria, right, which is a real standout at the moment in terms of the amount of debt outstanding. And I'm finding it fascinating that the Queensland election, of course, which is running at the moment, the two sides of politics there are playing very interesting little games, but neither of them want to tackle the real question there, which is, of course, again, the level of deficit.
No, well, they don't want to touch it, do they? It's just it's just the never never. Well, we've got all this mining revenue now, and that's just going to last forever. And that's it's a very 21st century Australian approach to things.
Spot on, exactly right. But the level of debt is going to be a problem, and of course, with the interest rates staying high for longer, that's going to cost a lot more, and so the debt servicing stuff is quite a big deal.
Well, I will just add something just very briefly, is that I do find it ironic, especially for Queensland, that You've got all these people, moving up there, particularly from Sydney and Melbourne, people who are concerned about climate change, people who tend to have a bit more financial means than the average. And Queensland's prosperity is built on coal mining. There's just this sort of a bit of irony there.
Well. Of course, we'll end up with nuclear as well if the other side of politics gets back in. So that'll solve the
Like
problem, won't
I guess we can hope that all the money that get potentially gets plowed into it results in a in some power being generated, but I mean, I'm not holding my breath.
No. It's more likely to be pulling the LNG out of the ground, liquefying it. Using about 7% of it to liquefy it, and then float it down in a boat to the southern states, and then deliquefy it again. That's more likely what we'll end up with.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Little mad.
Oh, that's Australia, mate. Okay, now, a couple of months ago, I put together an analysis that showed that for people under the age of 45, that their spending had basically gone nowhere. Their real consumer spending, ex housing costs, had basically gone nowhere or backwards over the last 20 years. Now, I think that this chart is a good illustration as to why. Because a lot fewer people own homes outright. And people who own homes outright tend to be more freely spending. They can then leverage that into maybe creating a business or doing something else productive. And, they've got all that extra free time on their hands because they don't have a mortgage to pay. As you mentioned previously, Martin, there's more and more people in those older demographics carrying mortgage debt right through to retirement and beyond. So that's even having a social impact beyond the sort of economic impact. And I just think that, this is part of why that Grattan Institute analysis that projects future home ownership rates for younger demographics out to, I think it was about 2050, shows that younger people are just going to own fewer and fewer homes. And there's, well, basically just property investors are just going to own more and more housing stock, really.
Yeah, and this is interesting that there's been a massive spike in property investors borrowing. If you look at the most recent data, I think it was up 35% year over year, right? Significantly above the owner-occupied sector. And once again, of course, the story is often the case that property investors are looking for a capital return over time rather than just income and revenue. But I do notice that whether you are a renter or whether you're an owner-occupier with a mortgage, there are more and more people now spending more than 45 to 50% of their disposable income just on their housing costs. And that is a remarkably horrendous statistic. And again, in my modeling, what I do is I take the gross income and then knock off the tax you have to pay and then look at what's left. And once you've paid for your rent and or mortgage, and then of course you've got things like your rates and your food and the other stuff. The ability for households to spend on discretionary things for many people are getting completely squeezed, and it comes right back to this issue of priority and trying to make your finances work. But the cost of housing has become such a huge proportion of people's total income over that evolution of time, and of course people have mortgages for a lot longer too. Now, the question is this going to ever revert? Or have we actually literally crossed the Rubicon and this is now the new normal? Because if it's the new normal, then the basic assumptions about the way that households run and the economics of households are in question, in my mind.
They are. And I think, to sort of once again go back to that analysis I was talking about, if you look at the numbers by age demographic, there is still very, very strong spending growth for people over the age of 55. And I think that part of that is the housing is the other end of the housing issue. It's the fact that these, people, this particular age demographic are the primary recipients of inheritances. Their parents pass on, they inherit the house. They're already in a position where people in that age demographic bought and afford tended to have already bought an affordable home. Because, well, you could back then. And so you've got this situation where you've got these people who either have a mortgage or are completely, sort of, footloose and fancy free, inheriting these enormous sums of money, which is then playing a significant role driving the economy. So you've got the young people struggling to grow their spending at all. And then you've got the older demographics who are growing their spending extremely strongly. So it's basically this self-reinforcing cycle of young people can't afford housing, housing gets more expensive, older people inherit houses, houses get sold, older people consume. So it's just this complete mess of a situation that's taken the traditional, house, the normal key spending demographics of being 18 to 49 and 25 to 54, just taken that and thrown it completely out the window.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, it's not just in Australia, it's in the same in the UK too. And I'm running the surveys here in the UK now and getting quite similar results. So what we're finding again is this idea of the wealth creation cycle through housing over the last 30 years now created significant amounts of equity. That equity then, well, in some cases it's being drawn down so that the bank of mum and dad, or even the bank of grandparents is providing abilities for the next generation to get on the bandwagon, as it were, with regard to property, and or people, fall off the perch, and ultimately then that equity is then created into cash. In the UK, there are actually death duties and things that need to be paid, but nevertheless, there's still some money that flows back through. So it's really distorting and warping the economic foundations of the country because of it. And I'm not sure, again, going back to the intergenerational report, that they ever actually thought about this in terms of the implications. And there was a, I think it was a Productivity Commission report that came out quite recently that once again highlighted the implications of the legacies of one generation to another generation. And when people fell off the perch, what happened to those money? And it was all linked to this massive bubble in housing. And I guess the last point to make is, I can't see any way that we're going to see property prices going through this cycle for the next 30 years again, which means that maybe this was a one in a generation or two of creation of equity, which will never happen again. So I'm not sure what the long-term strategy is as a result of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things is just going to be what see what happens with housing turnover, because it's going to get to a point where fewer and fewer people can afford to buy, because the people who are buying are overwhelmingly people with equity, people who have already have some home somewhere, who are selling it, who've managed to, sort of, ride the bubble, so to speak, to some degree. But if you look at young people, I mean, even, say we take, your surveys, you're talking like 60% of people or thereabouts, depending on, the data point in question, who are getting help from the bank of mum and dad. Another, almost another 40% of people are getting help from ALBO, through various home guarantee schemes. And then there's the people who are getting help through the various state government schemes, which you've also got to throw in there as well in terms of first home buyers. So basically, if you're a first home buyer and you're getting into the market on your own, well, you're rare as hen's teeth.
Yep.
So, it's like, as you say, it's created this self-reinforcing cycle. And the problem is the government and, well, I mean, I can't really blame parents. They're just doing their best. But
Yeah.
like the government just refuses to get out of the way and just let the market be the market. But instead, they're like they've gone from, basically not being a factor at all prior to the first home guarantee scheme, to the point now where they're almost 40% of first home buyer purchases involve ALBO. And if ALBO gets his shared equity scheme across the line, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if it's 50% plus of, it's just all ALBO all the time.
Yeah, I want to draw a quick analogy here. If you go back and look at Greek history and Greek storytelling, they have this idea of the gods looking down and intervening and messing with people, and it's almost like the politicians have become the modern equivalent of the ancient gods, looking down from on high and say, "Oh, we'll just do that," and we'll do a bit over there and we'll stop them doing it. It's almost like, you know, let the market be the market. That's, oh, can't do that.
No, well, I think the thing is that we've, you know, you look at the level of intervention in the market, you know, whether it's, you know, whether it's through first home buyers, whether it's through the bank of mom and dad, whether it's whatever it is, the market is no longer just the market,
yeah.
You know, where your dad is a fantastic illustration of this. You know, you go back to the early 2000s, you know, the proportion of people receiving help with buying a house was in single digits. And there's a very good reason for that, because you could afford to bloody buy one.
Spot on. Yeah. Yeah, very, very, very different now, unfortunately. Yeah, well, I don't know whether you've got more, but we've gone well over the time that we'd allotted.
Okay, well, maybe we should call it there, and we'll pick it up shortly. I think we'll have to definitely do this sooner than the duration between the last two chats, because we've got a US election to talk about.
Yeah. Well, we should definitely talk about the US election next time around. Just quickly to say that the Trump trade is on at the moment, according to the markets, although the opinion polls are all over the place. So I'm not sure that anybody quite knows what's really, really going on there. So I think the next two or three weeks will be quite interesting. And of course, the interesting question there, well, will it have an implication for Australia? Well, maybe on the next show, we'll know enough to be able to actually make some sensible conversation about it.
Yeah, no, that'd be good. I mean, I think it's only a couple of days after the election, is what, a fortnight from now? So
yeah,
looking forward to it.
All right. Well, thank you very much indeed to Tarek for coming on and sharing your thoughts and everything else. I know you've been frantically busy, but we'll put the links to the full article, which is a great read. So make sure people go off and check that. And I'll look forward to catching up with you as soon as we can, Tarek, and have a good weekend meetup.
Yeah, you too, mate. Thanks again for having us.
Cheers. Take care.
You too, mate. Bye.